This episode of the podcast is brought to you by my company, Horns of Odin. Now, Horns of Odin is a family-run business, and we sell Norse-inspired products. Particularly, we specialise in handmade, handcrafted drinking horns, which I made myself. But alongside that, we have a huge clothing collection. We sell a bunch of different meads. We've got beers and ales. We've got handmade jewellery, books, artwork. So if you like the sound of any of that, pop over to the website. It's www.hornsofodin.com. If you like anything, pop it in the cart. Use the code HORNS10 at checkout and you're going to get 10% off your entire order. Now that's HORNS10. It's going to get you 10% off your entire order. It's just a little thank you from us for listening to the podcast. The podcast is also brought to you by our website, NordicMythologyPodcast.com. Some of you have already seen that we've got a bunch of different merch on there. We've got some t-shirt designs. Now we've just added a brand new limited edition t-shirt. So there's only going to be 100 of these printed. After that, we're never going to print them again. So just pick one up whilst you can. So the design has been done by last week's guest, Jakob, aka Raven from the North, who was on last week's episode. It's a one-off design. Just pop over to the website, have a look. It's Odin and his two ravens. It's a really beautiful t-shirt. I'm definitely going to get one. I think we've sold probably about 25% of them already. So just pop over to NordicMythologyPodcast.com and have a look and see what you think. Right, let's jump into the show. Hello and welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, co-owner of the company Horns of Odin, and I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Matthias Nordvig.
Hello. So we are joined today by Rory Dale, who is you're a scholar of Berserkir, actually, but also a lot of other things. You've written a PhD thesis on the Berserkir, titled Berserkir, a re-examination of the phenomenon in literature and life. You've also worked on different projects that had to do with modern use and reimagination of the Vikings, among other things, editing a book called The Vikings Reimagined, Reception, Recovery, Engagement with Tom Burkett. And apart from that, Rory, you've done a lot of other things, and you're currently a project manager at the project called Enviros Citizens, as far as I understand, a Horizon 2020 project in Stavanger in Norway, trying to get people to care about the environment and possibly mixing in Vikings with that. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You also have quite a familiar accent, I think. It's very nice for me to hear somebody who's definitely spent some time around my neck of the world.
Yeah. I've spent rather more time than I care to think about near all. So that's whole to most people.
Yeah. In Yorkshire, we tend not to pronounce our H's. I'm over in Huddersfield, or Uddersfield, as we probably would pronounce. So where Hull's a special place. It's not one that I tend to visit too often.
It's probably where in the Viking Age there was a ferry running across the River Humber.
Okay.
And one of the great things about the Humber is, me being me and liking Vikings, I like to sit on the foreshore and imagine hundreds of Viking ships sailing up there in 1066 and then turning right at the end to go to Rickall near York, where Harald Hardrada had his last battle.
Perfect. I've never really thought of Hull as being a Viking town or city, I guess. And that's what I'm going to have to ask you now is, was it, or because it, now you've mentioned it, it makes sense that something would happen there because it is smack bang on a major river.
Yeah, I don't think Hull itself is Viking. I don't really know how far back it goes, but there are Viking age settlements along the Humber, including the lost port of Ravensur, which is near Spurn Point at the mouth of the Humber. Mm-hmm. And that's where Harald Hardrada's son, Olaf the Quiet, left England to return to Norway for his very quiet reign, from which he got his nickname. So That's all of that. And then the other thing about Sverne Point is that if you go out there, you'll see signs saying that the famous Icelandic poet, Egil Skallagrimsson, who anybody who's read Egil Saga will know about this guy, was wrecked there. His ship was wrecked at the mouth of the Humber, and the logical place would be on Sverne Point, because in a storm, that place gets washed over. And from there, he had to go up to York and compose poetry to save his neck. from Eric Bloodaxe and his wife, because they didn't like him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, of course. Ah, like initially when you guys started talking, I was like, oh, we've sort of like entered a Viking version of the Lord of the Rings kind of universe. Like, and then all of a sudden, bam, I got anchored in a saga. How wonderful!
Yeah. And of course, Sven Forkbeard, he sailed up the Humber as well. If he'd actually lived, then Gainsborough, just on the other side of the Humber, could well have been the capital of England. So it was a major artery.
Yeah.
So for anybody listening that isn't from Yorkshire, if you look at a map of the UK, on the right-hand side, about halfway down, there's what looks like a witch's finger. Well, that is what it was always described to me. Is that the River Humber? Am I right in that?
Yeah,
so glad I got that right. I would be so embarrassed if I got that wrong.
Yeah, that's the Humber. It was a major access for the Vikings to the interior of the country, because pretty much everywhere they went, they took their ships up the rivers. So you turn right at the end of the Humber and you get to York. You turn left, you head down to Nottingham, and you can wind up in Derby and Leicester.
Really? So you can access so many different places from going down the Humber?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
See, I guess these are little things that I've never really thought about until somebody says it. Then I'm like, oh, yeah, well, that does make complete sense.
It does, but we're not. Although England, well, the UK has always been a maritime nation, our modern lives are based around cars and roads. We don't think about the rivers as actually major arteries. And the Humber would have been the equivalent of like a big motorway at this point in time. So,
well, that's what I usually tell my students as well. I tell them, you know, in the Viking Age, the waterways are the highways, and this is sort of like a shared cultural aspect between the inhabitants of the British Isles and all of Scandinavia and the Baltic Sea in general. There's so much more that is connecting people across these oceans and waterways in different ways than anything else. And I think it's a really important, just in general, a really important aspect of understanding history to actually understand the physical space that we're dealing with as well.
And I think it's only recent times that we've stopped using the waterways so much. Only until recent times, Huddersfield was a huge sort of wool or, you know, wool place or fabric, a textile kind of hub of the country. And there's canals everywhere that they used to take and get things from point A to point B. It wasn't, you know, roads didn't exist in the way that they do now.
No, they didn't. I mean, you see that in the later industrial history of England as well, with the canals that took all that wool everywhere. And basically, when you start actually thinking about the Viking Age, particularly in terms of sailing time, you suddenly realize it's actually a heck of a lot quicker to get places by ship than it is by walking.
Yeah, of course. Definitely. So we're going to talk about Danelaw, or at least start out with Danelaw. I think the logical place to start is, what is Danelaw? Because I think there is so much misinformation or misconception about what it actually is. And you just hear, it's a phrase you tend to hear. But for me anyway, I've never really got a specific understanding of exactly what it is.
That's a good question, actually. And it's not one with a short answer.
we've got time. That's one thing we do have.
Yeah. Now, the very, very short answer is Danelaw is the place where the laws of the Danes applied in England.
Mm-hmm.
The slightly longer answer is it's a group of different areas that may or may not have been controlled centrally, probably weren't controlled centrally, but they sort of ran up the eastern half of England. Sorry, I have to do the sort of pointing thing to decide which way is east again. you know, when you sort of, you're looking around like that. So it ran up the eastern half of England. It's not a single unified kingdom. I think that's a good point to start with. There is the Northern Danelaw, which is the area north of the Humber, which people like Dawn Hadley have done a lot of work on. Which some people would prefer to be called the Kingdom of York because it was generally ruled from York. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the East Midlands area, which is the five boroughs. And the five boroughs are Derby, Leicester, Lincoln, Nottingham and Stamford. And then there's kind of, there's the East Anglia area, which is the area that Guthrum was king of, after he, and he got defeated by Alfred the Great and became Athelstan, just to complicate things. We're trying to remember which one he is. So there's kind of these three areas. And in common terms, we usually just lump them all together as the Danelaw because they were the areas where the Scandinavian laws applied. But in reality, you've got really three different areas.
So one question regarding this aspect of Scandinavian laws that apply. One of the things that I have learned regarding the laws is that there's actually not a lot of trace of Scandinavian law in or anything that we can sort of compare with later medieval Scandinavian laws, because obviously we don't have Viking Age laws available to read. What do you think of that subject? Like, how much of influence is there actually on this the local laws in the area?
It's really difficult to know. We don't really have those laws. What we do have is everything that sort of came in with Knut the Great when he took over in 1016 and became king of England and Denmark. And I think it's really from that period that we start to see things. And we don't know how far back some of those go. So can't really say to what extent they were exactly the same and differed. But we do know that when they were describing how the laws applied in England, even in the late, in sort of mid to late 10th century, they're still saying, yes, the laws in the eastern half are the laws of the Danes. They are different from the laws in the western half. So mm-hmm. that is actually written down. What those laws were specifically, we don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
So it would have been laws and not just this area is ruled by Danes. I get that's kind of what I was just thinking is whether is it, this area is run by Danes and they kind of just do their thing and listen to them? Or would they have had specific laws of the land?
Actually, this is now a really good question about what you mean by law. Because,
I guess, yeah.
Because actually, in this period, you're probably actually just talking about customary practice more. Mm-hmm. It's not law as we might think about it. It's just this is our way of doing things.
Do it or else.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah,
I mean, we can see some other things as well. Like the place name material pretty strongly suggests that the line that separates the Danelaw from the rest of the English area, regardless of how nebulous it gets farther north, this is also sort of the separating line between where we find place names from Scandinavians and not. There's like a few here and there on the other side of the line in the Mercian area, as far as I remember. But aside from that, it's all like East Anglia, Five Boroughs, and Northern England that has the place names from Scandinavia, right?
Yeah, the place names are actually really interesting because you get a good mix as well. You get purely Old Norse place names, so that means that you have Viking-type people settling there and you've got a dominant Old Norse language. But you're also getting, you do get Old English place names in the areas.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got your Anglo-Saxon inhabitants or Old English-speaking inhabitants settled there still in among the Vikings. Or does that mean the Vikings are actually settling in among the Anglo-Saxons?
Well, it depends who's in charge. So
it does. Yeah. And then you've also got what they call Grimston hybrids or totem hybrids, which are Old Norse personal names with the Old English tune at the end meaning farm.
Yeah.
So you've got a mix like that. And then just to complicate things further, there's Rutland, just slightly to the east of Leicester, Leicestershire, I should say. It's an enclave of Old English place names with, I think there's one or two Old Norse place names in there. And it is absolutely distinct from everything else around it. So the theory, as far as I understand it, is that this area was a dower area. It belonged to one of the Anglo-Saxon princesses or queens. And for the life of me, I cannot remember her name now, for which I apologize. But that this area was therefore defined as sort of Anglo-Saxon controlled
mm-hmm.
at this time. And yet it's slap bang in the middle of all the Old Norse place names.
Mm.
And then as you come further west, there's not really an absolute cutoff. You kind of get the Old Norse names petering out, which kind of suggests that you've actually got a permeable boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And the only definite boundary you've got is the one that appears to have been agreed between Alfred and Guthrum at the Treaty of Wedmore in the 870s, which is Watling Street, the old Roman road, which is interesting in its own right because it's basically suggesting that this feature is still a significant part of the landscape.
Mm.
And a logical boundary.
Right. That's really interesting. And another thing about place names, as far as I remember, post-Norman invasion, what it looks like we also get is a couple of Norman personal names with Nordic suffixes of various kinds, like Robberby, which just fascinates me because that then suggests that there is some kind of crossover between Normans and Scandinavians, or what is your take on that?
It might be crossover, or it could just be that the place name element became part of the language in the same way as gate did. Gate is Old Norse gata, meaning a street. But being from Uddersfield, you'll know that gate is just another word for a street. Now, you know, and in the north of England, you get a lot of gate street names. So it can be difficult, unless you've got very early evidence for it, to know whether it's actually Viking Age or whether it's a medieval street name. And likewise with the Bee place name, it could be later because there are a lot of parts of Old Norse that became part of the English language. And especially in local dialects, they just become normal words, which means that when you're actually looking at the place names, you've just got to actually go back as far as you can. Mm. Sometimes you've just got to say, well, it only goes as far as, the medieval period.
Mm.
But I mean, you get it, especially around where I live. When I was a kid, people would come out and say, you're Lakin. Laker to play,
mm-hmm.
you know, or it's silent it down, which again, yeah, Matthias, you recognize the word, you know, yeah. It's raining hard.
Yeah.
and these are all words that come in from Old Norse and sometimes a bit later on.
I never knew that. They're ones obviously I've heard from being a northerner, but I never knew they were all Norse.
Yeah, so that's where they come from. But I mean, when we're speaking English, we're speaking Old Norse every single day, and it's some of the most basic words. Mm-hmm. Egg comes from the Old Norse.
Yeah, because otherwise you guys would have a really weird pronunciation of that word. Like if it was the old Saxon word, og.
So how do we end up with Danelaw in England? Like, how do we end up with these three boroughs that are run or ran by Vikings?
Basically, what happened was that Alfred the Great, after burning cakes in the marshes of Athelney and everything else, got lucky in battle against... I shouldn't say about that, should I? he beat the Vikings at Edington, and Guthrum then basically had to negotiate a treaty with him. And the treaty between the two of them defined the boundary of the Danelaw between Wessex and East Anglia, because this was between the King of Wessex and the King of East Anglia, not the King of all the Vikings on the east side of the country and the King of all the English on the other side of the country. And that's quite important for actually deciding where the Danelaw bound, you know, for knowing, realizing that we don't actually know precisely where the Danelaw boundary runs north of the area controlled by Wessex. So basically, they negotiated a treaty. Guthrum converted to Christianity with 30 of his men. He changed his name to Athelstan to show that he was a good egg and part of the Anglo-Saxon society now. And that's basically what it is. And after that, Guthrum kind of goes quiet. We find coins and things of his up through till his death, which I think was about 890. And he kind of goes quiet in East Anglia, but that's how the Danelaw got kind of codified, shall we say. It got formalized.
So does that mean that Guthrum answers to Alfred effectively if he allowed him to kind of have this area? Would it be in the back of his mind that that's there, or is it you just go and do your thing over there and leave us alone?
I think it was a bit more of you go do your thing over there and leave us alone, although the sources from Wessex tell us what a great victory it was.
Mm-hmm.
Given how things had been, I suspect that actually what Alfred did was brought the incoming Danes to a standstill, which is why he had to negotiate a treaty rather than subjugating them completely.
Okay, yeah, obviously if he had won one, then he would have kind of pushed them out and had his own way, not just allowed one of them to be in charge, I guess.
I think so. But it's very difficult to say from the sources. This is more kind of my perspective on it, because we don't have anything that says, I should say what we have is Wessex propaganda in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which basically writes out Mercia as not important, despite the fact that Mercia is actually really very powerful.
It's always a perspective of whoever's writing it, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. This is where the archaeological evidence comes in as well, because although most of the written evidence comes from Wessex, we started finding what they call two emperors' pennies, which are thought to depict Alfred and, I always get this one wrong, it's Ceolwulf of Mercia. And he was described in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle as a foolish churl or something like that, whom the Scandinavian invaders had installed on the throne of Mercia. But you're getting these two emperor's pennies, which suggests something much more different. It's suggesting that he was actually equal to Alfred, mm-hmm. and that they had some kind of negotiated relationship going on with the two of them represented as emperors.
So it was a co-regent, basically, or something like that. Yeah.
And if it wasn't for metal detecting in England and people actually reporting the finds that they got, we wouldn't know this. We'd still think this guy was some puppet of the Danes who'd been installed in Mercia.
Good old Brits and their metal detectors, eh?
Well, it works really well when people report their finds properly, because what you get is a vast amount of data. And when I wrote the Viking Leicestershire book, a huge chunk of what I actually looked at was the metal detective finds. And one of the things that struck me was how many of them came from beside the rivers, to go back to rivers as highways. So, yeah.
I think one thing that I find really interesting is Guthrum converting to Christianity, because it seems to be, at the minute, kind of that you see online amongst fans of this culture and fans of like the Viking Age, there seems to be a very negative thought of that Christianity kind of pulverized and forced and made everyone at bended knee convert to Christianity. And it seems to be very, very negatively perceived, when in reality, a lot of people converted because, I guess in Guthrum's case, it was for monetary and political gain. So it made sense for him to convert. So it wasn't necessarily forced on as it seems to be kind of seen in modern ideas.
Yeah. Basically, the pre-Christian Scandinavians were essentially very pragmatic. There's a marvellous story in one of the sagas, and I'm hoping Matthias will actually remind me precisely which one it is, where the guy turns around and he basically says, well, you know, when I go to sea, I pray to Thor because he's always looked after me when I go to sea. But on land, I'm very happy with this Jesus Christ guy because he's looking after me here.
Yes, that's Helgi the Lean. I think that's mentioned in the Book of Settlements, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
So you've got this pragmatic attitude, and when Guthrum's converting to Christianity, it does several things. First off, it shows that he's acting in good faith with Alfred. Secondly, by converting to Christianity, it means he can interact with the Christians, not only in that part of England, but also across Europe. And there's very much a sense that converting to Christianity gives you access to markets and power that otherwise you might not have had.
I think we should not forget the aspect of this, that is also that, if he did not convert to Christianity, then all of a sudden we have an ambiguous religious situation territorially, so to speak, in the English area, right? So this was a, like, it, they wouldn't be able to settle this treaty unless he converted to Christianity, right?
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I imagine Alfred can sell it a lot better to his people that we're allowing them to have this area because he's now Christian, rather than we've given this area to one of the Danish folk that keep coming and killing us.
There's also the very real risk of a continuing war afterwards, because next level would be that, okay, so if he didn't convert to Christianity, and now they then have a heathen king over there in East Anglia, then we also have a reason to start a crusade. Right. This is right around that time where crusades are becoming a thing, so to speak. I mean, it, depending on how you want to define a crusade, but we have Charlemagne, who sets sort of the tone for how we can deal with non-Christian polities in sort of like the European periphery, right? He invades Saxony and Frisia, but basically going, they need Christianity. And it's obviously because he lost the territory, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is the same situation that we're also dealing with the conversion in England, where we have religious wars, where Mercia is the last place to fall in a war, That's what that is, a war to Christianize Mercia. And so, you know, it would be a step back if he didn't convert to Christianity, right?
Yeah, it was necessary for the peace, really. And I'm sure Guthrum was politician enough to realize that and to realize the benefits that would accrue to him. I mean, the fact that he was sitting in East Anglia, ruling the place, minting coins in his own name, and generally just sort of, yeah, living it up there, as it were.
Absolutely. I think it does such a disservice, this idea of Christianity literally just being forced upon everyone. And it does a disservice to Vikings in their ingenuity that it's taken opportunity whilst it's there and gain, you know, everybody wants to gain what they can. So if somebody offers you land and wealth and whatever else you want, you're going to take it if it just means agreeing to something that I guess maybe he didn't. It doesn't. Who knows whether he really believed it or not, as long as you say you do to the right people, I guess.
Well, there's the question. How much did they believe it? I mean, the other one that you see is a lot of people getting crime signs so that they have just the very basic, dare I call it a baptism, Matthias?
No, it's not baptism, right? It's basically sort of like a get out of jail card for free, where you don't have to get baptized. You're prime signed, which means that you've gone to a couple of ceremonies in church, but you're not Christian yet. So you're like, the intention is, of course, that you become Christian. Remember that, you know, just for everybody's information, the rituals and ceremonies involved in becoming Christian back in the medieval period were much more elaborate than they are today. Today they just dunk you in water and then you're fine, right? sometimes in the river, but you had to like go through a bunch of rituals.
That feels very much like both sides understand what's going on, but neither of them want to say it, but they both understand that it's just an agreement and maybe you don't have to really believe in it. We're going to turn a blind eye. You guys do what you've got to do. We all kind of live peacefully and get on with it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Once you're prime signed, it means you can trade with Christians and, you know, you've made the right kind of moves and everybody goes, okay, you know, you may not be quite all the way there yet, but it's enough that nobody's going to have a go at us for actually dealing with you.
Mm.
Exactly. It's trying to keep everybody happy, I guess.
Yeah.
So if Guthrum has East Anglia, you said there was three areas.
Yeah.
Do the other two have their own kind of Danish, Viking, Christian, amalgamation, king type situation?
Oh, this is where it gets it complicated. We don't really understand the political organization of the five boroughs area, which is the East Midlands. So I'm going to come back to that one in a moment.
Okay.
But then once you're north of the Humber and you've got the Viking kings in York, basically they are controlling that area.
Are they the sons of Ragnar? Is that where we're at this point in history? Because it's quite, again, quite nebulous, actually, who rule that area at that time and like, where do they come from? Who do they descend from? And all of that stuff, right?
I think part of that's because it's quite mixed. Mm-hmm. The earliest part, you've got the sort of the legendary types who appear in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Around the time of Guthrum and a little bit later than that, around 890-ish, you've got a Knut of Northumbria minting coins, and they've been found in the East Midlands area.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit later again, you get Eric Bloodaxe, who everybody's heard of and is descended from Harald Fairhair. And you get Norse kings coming in from Ireland when they get kicked out of Ireland. So it gets very messy.
Yeah, no, this is interesting, right? Because I think it's very interesting because what we have next is a bunch of Scandinavians falling over each other, trying to claim all of these Vikings kings, right? And that's where it gets really messy. For instance, with Ragnar, and like, where was he from? From some random island in Denmark or some random fjord in Norway? You know, it's all just, you know, kind of silly.
Yeah, it gets quite messy, and we can kind of pull them all together, but really, you know, it's a but. Like cats fighting in a sack. Can we say that?
Say whatever you want.
I like that visual, yes.
But I don't approve of that visual, but yeah, it's a lot of people basically trying to take over, and it's all ruled from York. But you've got Scandinavians over in Cumbria and down to the Wirral, where I think it was Stephen Harding did a Viking DNA project looking back at people and basically saying, yep, we can actually trace a lot of Scandinavian stuff, Scandinavian descent in this area. And they in theory came through from Ireland. So they're everywhere. They're everywhere. There's no getting away from them. Yeah. And then we come down to the East Midlands, and that's just that. Oh. We've got the five boroughs. This is what we know.
Would I be right in thinking that it's a bunch of different groups of quote unquote Vikings that come and maybe take a little bit of land for themselves or settle in an area? So even though you've got a group of people who are technically all the same in the word Viking, they don't know each other and have no alliance with each other. So they would fight amongst themselves to claim who was king. So there would be a bunch of infighting.
Not so much in the East Midlands. In the East Midlands, that's the area that was the stamping ground of what's known as the Great Heathen Army. So these are the guys who came over. They sailed up the Humber. They sailed down the Trent, and then I think originally they actually came in through East Anglia and came up and headed up into the East Midlands area. And then around early 870s, they camp at Torksey, and that's recorded in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And there's been a lot of archaeological work done or metal detecting work done in the Torksey area. And they've identified what was probably a settlement of up to 5,000 people as a winter camp. With strong evidence of production, weaving, metalworking, basically all the basics of what production of things that you needed to live. And there is absolutely no surprise that this camp is actually beside the river. You know, it's kind of find your longship parking spot and pull into the camp.
So this is before Danelaw's established as a as a thing.
Yes, this is before the Danelaw. This is the ruckus that happened as they're sort of coming in and making space for themselves. Mm-hmm.
This is the part of the story that makes Alfred the Great shit himself and think maybe we should seek some kind of solution with these guys.
That's it. So, I mean, they come in there, but what's really interesting, sort of coming back to Torksey, what's really interesting is that you're getting evidence for in terms of trefoil brooches, which are typical women's wear. You're getting weaving materials, which is typically a woman's job in this period. You're getting the metalworking, which could have been done by anybody, really. You know, you're getting punches for decorating arm rings, that kind of thing. And you're getting these lead gaming pieces, which I am absolutely fascinated by, because they're just little conical lead gaming pieces that you could make by just pushing your finger into a mold and then pouring lead into that hole. They're everywhere. They seem to be a marker for Viking camps. So people are sitting down playing Hnefatafl or Nine Men's Morris in these camps, and it's looking very much like they're not actually armies per se. It's more like a great big caravan with maybe 1,000 odd fighters there, and everybody else is the tail. It's the supplies and everything else. And the fact there's women there means there's kids there too. So you've got women and children in these camps. You've got the men there.
Just one thing that strikes me here. You said about 5,000 people?
Yes. The camp is large enough for 5,000 people. And I do wonder if actual further work won't show that maybe there were even more.
This is incredible, because what this means then is that we have a bunch of Scandinavians that go over there to a new land and establish what is essentially like a metropolitan area for that time that is larger than anything that is present or have been present in the Scandinavian mainland until, you know, way into places like Stockholm and Copenhagen at some point reached 5,000 people in the early modern period, right? But yeah. Like, if we compare with the largest Viking age town in Scandinavia, Hedeby, that's only 1,500 people approximately, right? To 2,000. Yeah. So that's incredible.
So you've got a tent city on the banks of the Trent. And then you go down to Repton, the camp the year after, and you get the burial mounds nearby. You get the charnel pit, which is 20% women and children and 80% men. And you've got the work that's being done there by Kat is showing that that was a heck of a lot bigger than people originally thought too. And there's another Viking camp just to the southwest of that on the Leicestershire-Derbyshire border, or what they think was a Viking camp. It's turning up the diagnostic artifacts. You've got all this stuff. You've got this huge caravan of people coming in, and they're coming from everywhere based on the place name evidence, which is the other interesting thing. If we look at the place name evidence, we've got, for example, Sisenby in Leicestershire, which is Sigstein's farm. Sigstein is a typically Swedish name in this period. You've got Rotherby and Rearsby, which are Hreidar's farm. Both of those mean Hreidar's farm. And that's a typically Norwegian name in this period. And then, not to leave Matthias out, you've got Sjoby, which is Sigvalder's farm, which is a typically Danish or possibly Norwegian name. So you've got people coming from all over. And then my favourite one, Frisby on the Reek in Leicestershire, is the Frisians farm, as in lots of Frisians, not just one. You know, it's a plural form of the word. So you've also got these people coming from this sort of northwestern coast of sort of the Netherlands area and settling there.
So basically what we're seeing in this demographic that we just got right here is that all of these people seem to have something in common. If nothing else, their interest in that land that they can take there over there, and they seem to be represented with the same or similar identity from at least the English side of things, right? The English, though, they would be able to recognize the difference between Scandinavians and Frisians. They were well acquainted with Frisians, right?
Yeah.
We don't see much mention of Frisians in the sources, though, right?
It doesn't mean there were lots of them in the Great Army.
Okay.
The place name evidence physically puts them on the map. And it makes you also wonder who else has been written out of it. How many local lads fancied their chances, thinking, oh, yeah, I can make a few arm rings here if I join up with this mob. This is why I would prefer to refer to this as a Viking army as well, because it's a group of a lot of different people with different identities, but coming together to do one thing, which is basically take the land in the end.
So can we then say that in this particular context, Viking is actually the primary identity of these people rather than the whatever Scandinavian background they have, a regional background?
Well, without a time machine, I can't answer that question clearly, but I cannot think of a better term that we would use other than referring to them as the Great Army.
Right.
That describes what they're doing. I mean, they're coming in and they're taking stuff, and then they're going, right, this is time to settle down, and they're settling down. and they're settling down in amongst the existing population. And interestingly, they're leaving them on some of the better land at times. On some of the riverside sites, you see that the old English place names are all along the river. And then you get up onto the higher ground and you start to get sort of slightly less good land and you start to get the Old Norse place names.
So they're taking the outlier farms.
Yeah, yeah, they're taking the sort of, there's a theory that they're actually taking the sort of slightly less good land and leaving the other people there. So, I mean, I've got an idea that you've got a bunch of guys going, oh, God, I just want a farm. Just leave me in peace. And they go, you know, so your Scandinavian farmer comes along and settles down and goes to his Anglo-Saxon neighbor. Oh, you know, look, I just want a peace, okay? Let's let those high-ups, so the big guys, just do their fighting and let's just get on.
Right. So this is now I'm going to nerd out about the if like land use in Scandinavia as well, because and place names again, because we have the Thorpr place names that are emerging in the thousands and become incredibly relevant in the 1100s in the Scandinavian landscape, right? And these are typically outlier farms, right? You have sort of like a demographic development where you have a center, an old center that has probably existed since before the Iron Age. And then all of a sudden we have this new demographic development that puts outlier farms called Thorpe something or something Thorpe around them. And this seems like a similar sort of like development. It's usually on poorer land. It's a little harder to work it. And I don't know, like, is this reflective of something that is happening, experiences that Scandinavians are having in the English area? That then
I think so. I mean, yeah. We do get the Thorpe place names as well. In fact, one of my favorite place names in Nottinghamshire is Gunthorpe, which is Gunhild's Thorpe.
Yeah.
And it's one of the few place names where there's a definite woman's name. So Gunhild, whoever she was important enough to have this farm named after her,
mm-hmm.
Which I think, again, is fascinating because it takes us away from the sort of hairy badass man attitude, sort of perspective. So she's there on this farm, and we kind of see the development with the Bue place names being earlier and the Thorpe place names being a bit later. So as people are settling, you're getting the outlying farms set up as well.
I think it's really fascinating to think about, like, so the popular perception of the Danelaw and all that stuff and the Viking presence in England is one that has to do with like violence and warfare and people taking your shit kind of attitudes. But what we're really seeing when we start digging into all of this is that this is a very sort of like innovative period. What we see is a reinvigoration of old town centers in the English area. And then what we see on the other side of the North Sea in the Danish area, also in this Norwegian area, is new societal developments that are directly reflecting what is happening in the British Isles. Like, so there's constant communication. There's constant development and inspiration happening, basically, on all levels. I mean, even some have suggested that the runic monuments in Scandinavia are inspired by what they see in the English area. So, yeah.
That would be interesting if true. I don't know enough about that myself.
I mean, we do have runic monuments before the Viking migrations, but there is something that seems to be there's something that seems to happen with the so-called Danish era of the runic monuments that is before the year 1000, I guess, through the 900s and 800s. That looks like they are getting inspired by what they're seeing in the English monumentalism, and of course we also have the hogback stones and all that stuff up in the north. So,
well, you get them as far south as Nottingham.
Oh yes, that's right.
There's the Hickling hogback, which is a very interesting mix of Scandinavian pre-Christian art with a dirty great big cross whacked in the middle of it. if anybody who's listening wants to see a picture of it, go to emidsvikings.ac.uk and Google and search for the Hickling Hogback. There's pictures of it on there. So this is somebody with a Scandinavian identity who's also saying, yeah, I want you to know I'm also Christian. And there's a lot of Anglo-Scandinavian sculpture sort of developing it. I mean, that's fascinating in its own right. I do want to go back to your point about reinvigorating the towns, though, because mm-hmm. that's actually a very important part about the five boroughs in the East Midlands area, because four of those towns, Lincoln, Derby, Leicester and Nottingham, are all now county towns.
Mm.
And I am firmly of the view that they are county towns because the Vikings who came in and settled made them important enough for them to actually retain that importance all the way through. Because, I mean, as we know, the Normans came in and they basically took over the bureaucracy and they, so that they could run the country.
Mm.
But you've got a lot of evidence for the Vikings in these towns. And if they'd had a site like Coppergate in York, which had the circumstances been different, they could almost certainly have had. We might not have been going to the Jorvik Centre. We might have been going to the Leodochester Centre in Leicester or the Snottingham Centre in Nottingham.
It's not got the same ring, though, has it?
Oh, I don't know. I'd go to Snottingham.
before we get too far away, so just this idea of there have been 5,000 people camped. Now, as Matthias said, the biggest Viking settlement back in Scandinavia was, 1,500? So that means that these people have not come from one single location. It means that there must have been a huge collaborative effort to bring together this army from different groups, different peoples, different kingdoms, different countries, I guess, all to be there at the same time. That just seems like such a big effort and a big ask.
Well, it kind of is, but I don't think it's quite as organized as that. You've got people coming over and you've got the armies, and the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle records different armies joining together. But also you've got all the armies that were in Francia as the Franks kind of got their stuff together and worked out how to keep the Vikings out. The Vikings came to England because it was a slightly softer target. You've got them sort of kind of coming together, but they're coming together from, I mean, as I said on the place name evidence, they're coming together from a lot of different places.
But surely they must have all had an idea that they were going to meet up in this one place at the same time.
It's a good question. I don't have an answer to that one particularly.
I know what you say. I mean, I guess everybody probably knows of this nice green pasture place where they can steal stuff and farm, and it's this wonderful area. But to all end up in one area at the same time, and I guess, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. It probably happens over the span of a year or longer. But it just seems like so many people all in one place.
It is. And, I mean, quite frankly, I have no clue quite how they organised it, you know. You send out a carrier raven or something.
Well, that's it. It just seems like such an impressive collaborative effort to get so many people from so many different places all in one area and be like, under one united goal.
So we're in the 860s, right? From the beginning of the 860s. What we need for that to happen, right, is a couple of magnates or chieftains or kings or whatever you want to call them in the Danish area who have various kinds of either marriage, family, or friendship alliances with one another, right? So let's say Olaf the Hairy, because I just love Blackadder, Olaf the Hairy in Denmark, he's like, well, okay, there's already been a couple of dudes over there invading England and trying it out, and they didn't go that well, but you know, let's try a new one. Let's see if my friend or my cousin Harold the Bigfooted in Western Norway is down. So we'll send my carrier raven over there, and then, you know, basically what we're doing is that in the entire area, and also, you know, some of those buddies down in Frisia, and then slowly after the carrier ravens come back, we have an actual army, and then we all convene on the English shores on that particular date.
Yeah, right? But 5,000 is such a big number compared to, like, to go back to you saying, like, 1,500 is the biggest. So if they sent 10% of everybody there, that's only, what, 150 people? And, I mean, I imagine they wouldn't send 10% of their entire population.
Well, no. So this is where it gets interesting, right? Because when we start digging, literally, in archaeology, digging into different sites in Scandinavia, we do find some interesting things happening. There's Randlev Hesselbjerg, just south of my hometown, Aarhus, in Denmark, which seems to have had hardly any men at certain periods in time, where it was more or less controlled by women, the town. Probably the presumption is that this is probably because all these men, they're actually out dying in Viking raids. So you could have a straight up depopulation of an area for the purpose of raiding England. And so I guess it's like a cost benefit analysis. Like,
there has to be that one guy who's just like, no, you guys go. I'll just hang back here with all the women. No,
absolutely.
You go, don't you worry, I'll stay here.
That Viking Age burial ground in Randlev Hesselbjerg, that has about 20% males and 80% females. So there was a couple of men that were definitely like, yeah, I'll just stay here and, you know, check on the plow.
I think that figure's probably the most that's blown my mind ever on this podcast, because it just seems like such a big number compared to the size of what an individual population would be. I mean, do we know what the population of England or Britain would have been? Or roughly? Because I have no idea.
I wouldn't venture a guess on that. So one of the interesting things here is that depending on so like how ambitious and optimistic you are with your Icelandic history, we see Icelanders... Icelandic historians having basically set the number of people present in Viking Age Iceland between 10,000 and 60,000, right?
Okay.
So it's like you can end up with some serious estimates, seriously interesting estimates, so to speak, based off of how optimistic you are about the calculations that you're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if that's Iceland, which is a farther, much farther north area, right? Then that begs the question: like, what does that look like down in the English area? And I dare not do any estimates.
I mean, the only way you'll really get to know about it is by counting up what's in Domesday Book in 1086, but that won't tell you what the 9th century population was.
No.
Okay, so Mike's just pulled up. He said, according to Google, so we don't know whether we can trust this or not. He says the population of England in around 1086 is 1.5 million. Seems like a lot of people. It was more than I was expecting.
I think that's reasonable.
I'd have said like 100,000 max.
No, it's I think that's a reasonable estimate.
It would be. I don't know. I'm just a fool. Don't listen to anything I ever say.
I mean, with modern farming technologies and import of food and all that stuff, you guys have what, like almost 60 million at this point?
64 and a half, 65.
See, there you go. So,
okay, so we have, if we're going on a linear route towards Danelaw and its establishment, we have 5,000 people camped. What goes next? I'm guessing a giant war. A big battle?
You hear about various sort of marches southwards to attack the areas that they're not actually living in. So yeah, there's a fair few rucks over the next few years, and that all culminates in Alfred and Guthrum fighting it out, and eventually Alfred managing to win.
So is Guthrum part of the Great Heathen Army?
He arrived in East Anglia around 870, 871-ish, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, he's part of the second contingent, right?
Yeah.
Of the sort of like, what do you call that? New recruits for the Heathen Army.
These are the ones who are arriving from Francia, who are basically saying, "Oh, it's getting too hot to handle over there. We're coming here."
Okay, so it's an established settlement by this point, and then new people come in and help push it forward, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're getting settlements established. You're still getting the lads in the army going off and doing their thing. But eventually they start actually settling down properly from the time of the Treaty of Wedmore, thereabouts. But I mean, that doesn't stop them attacking again, because we know that Hastein came over with his wife and attacked London in the 890s, which I think was in the Vikings TV series, wasn't it?
No, it was in The Last Kingdom.
Last Kingdom, yeah.
So does the Great Heathen Army have one single ruler who says, "You lot do what I say," or is it a bunch of different? How does that work?
Good question. There must have been someone or some others at the top. I mean, you've got the sons of Ragnar Lothbrok are supposed to be kicking around in England at this time.
I feel like I've heard the Ivar's part of the Great Heathen Army. I don't know how accurate that is.
Yeah, it's Ivar the Boneless and Rune the Tempter, I want to say. I mean, Ubba. God.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, too much Last Kingdom watching going on here. Let's at the center of that line. And Ubba, I think, is one of the ones who's supposed to have been in East Anglia in 869, killed off King Edmund, who became St. Edmund. Together with Guthrum. So that's basically where these guys are.
Do we find, when you say like people like Ivar and Ubba, how accurate is it that we know that they were actually there, or is it part of like these legendary figures that you want to attach to this legendary sized army?
If they're mentioned in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, we can accept them having some kind of historical reality.
Yeah.
But, and there's a big but here, that doesn't mean that the saga of Ragnar Lothbrok and the saga of the sons of Ragnar Lothbrok are actually historically accurate about this.
So, Roderick, whilst we're on the topic of Ragnar, do you think he existed as a single individual? I know me and Matthias have spoke about it before, and I know, Matthias, you mentioned that this is going way back to one of our very early episodes, that Ragnar could mean almost a title, I guess, and that's why he appears in all these different areas at the same time, while, you know, geographically miles and thousands of miles apart.
Yeah, it's a good question. My usual response would be probably in some form, but not how we remember him.
Okay, that feels like a political answer.
Well, it kind of it is and it isn't. I mean, essentially, I mostly know him from reading his saga, and that was not a real person as such. But
no, I mean, I guess killing a dragon would always kind of
undermine me here. I'm trying to write my own saga. I've killed several dragons already.
Well, this is the thing as well, I guess. Especially back then, you know, Matthias, you do a lot of walking up in the mountains, and I guess, you know, you are on your own with nobody around for miles and miles. You could say you killed a dragon, or at least in more kind of more modern terms, you could say you could run back home and be like, you know what, I just fought a bear off with my bare hands, and you know, I fucked it up. I won. And nobody could technically say you're wrong, even though I wouldn't necessarily believe you. You could create a saga around that and post it on Facebook as Matthias the Bear Killer.
I guess I could.
but I get this is one of these, like, I'm sure that's how some sagas must have started.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That yes, that is very, very obvious. I mean, we even have several mentions of Lygisögur, right?
Yeah.
So lying stories. So they were very much aware that there were people just bullshitting out there.
Absolutely, but they still liked them.
Yeah, absolutely. It would still be a nice and interesting story.
Yeah.
A good story is one that has a few lies in it. You know, why ruin a good story without, you know, with the truth?
It's like what they say at the end of The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Why publish the truth when you can publish the legend?
That's it. It makes for a better story.
Yeah.
So, you know, especially when you're sat around trying to entertain people, I imagine, you know, if it's what's adding a few little dragons and trolls and giants to fluff up the story a little bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So just to divert or revert back to this the subject of Danelaw, one thing I'm interested in is Guthrum sort of like where we start seeing the integration of English primarily, but British perhaps more broadly, and Scandinavian elite in different ways. Is that where the crossovers begin, or do they come later on?
I would think that's probably a starting point that we can actually put a name and date to. I would not be at all surprised to see it happening earlier, and we just don't have the data for it. I mean, there has to have been contact with Scandinavia, even before the Viking Age.
Yeah.
I actually almost think that the elites form their own identity across Europe in many ways.
Yeah.
That they have more in common with each other than they do with the ordinary people on the farms.
Yeah, now we're going to get.
No, I'm not going there, but I am going to go. No. I'm just going to go back to Sutton Hoo and point out that Sutton Hoo shows very strong connections with Sweden.
Yeah.
All the way back, very early in the sort of time when the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes are arriving in England.
Yeah.
The connections are there all that way back, and we've got the physical evidence for it with Sutton Hoo.
So yeah. Would that suggest that there were Swedes living in that area? So it's a long time before the Viking Age.
I don't know if it necessarily means that Swedes are living there. That would be something for somebody who deals with this earlier material to sort of say
okay.
Yay or nay to. But I would say that it definitely shows political connections. It shows kinds of cultural connections. You look at, for example, the helmet plates on the Sutton Hoo helmets and compare them to the helmet plates on the helmets at Vendel and Valsjärra in Sweden. And you're getting very similar iconography, and you're getting similar from the helmet plates from the Staffordshire Board and basically, a lot of this elite culture seems to be feeding off each other, and whether that's because they're all trying to make themselves out to be the logical successors of the Romans, I don't know, but there is that argument has been made.
Mm. Despite all the arguments regarding Beowulf and its age and all of these things, I mean, I think there is something to be said for the political relevance of the connections between royal houses and elites in the English area and in, well, Sweden and also Denmark for that matter, because that's also where it takes place, right? There is at least one theory out there regarding Beowulf as a poem and a significant text that suggests that it, as far as I remember, was originally written down around Alfred's time when he settled the peace with Guthrum and created the Danelaw, sort of as a way to integrate Scandinavian mythology or ideological foundations to and into sort of the English cultural context. That's at least a theory that I can't remember who has proposed this. But it is just interesting to think of then that means then that there's Scandinavian cultural commodities, so to speak, ideological commodities that are relevant in the English context and seem to have very deep roots as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not even going to touch on the dating of Beowulf. I'm happy to stick with the, it was almost certainly written down early 11th century, and I'm really not going to get into that fight.
No.
You know, the fact that it was relevant to people living in England has got to mean something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. It's just got to show that the connections are there.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So, how long did the Danelaw survive? What brings it to an end?
Oh, it's Alfred's son and grandson and daughter, I should add. Basically, East Anglia was reconquered first, or annexed by Wessex, and then Edward the Elder and Ethelflaed, the children of Alfred. Ethelflaed took back Leicester, but died shortly after. Then Edward the Elder came in and took back Leicester and Nottingham, and he built burhs there, he built fortifications there to defend them. And that's all happening around the 910s, around 918-ish. And according to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which we know is quite propagandistic, Edward the Elder and Ethelflaed had magnificent victories and they took it all back and all the Vikings in those areas had to submit to them. The evidence is a bit more equivocal when you start looking at the archaeology, though, because you start finding from places like Thurcaston and Leicestershire, you've got silver ingots, you've got coins from all over the place, from Northumbria, from all around England. But what that means is these coins would not have been legal tender in a monetary economy because the coins were always re-minted with the appropriate king's head on.
Mm.
Which suggests that you've still got a mixed economy in the Danelaw at this period of bullion. So they would have cut the coins up to pay things like, you know, I want to buy myself a curly whirly at the news agents down the street or something. So I chop a bit off my arm ring to pay for it. Alongside a monetary economy with coins. So it's quite likely that the Five Boroughs area retained a bit more autonomy than Edward wanted us to actually think.
Mm.
But then his son then comes in later and actually forces, takes it all back properly and gets the kings in York to submit to him. So it's a process that happens through the 10th century, the taking back of it. So it probably lasted about 50 years as a thing in its own right.
Okay. Before we wrap up on Danelaw, was there any single events that kind of triggered the retaking of this land by the Anglo-Saxons? Or was it a case of let's wait until we are able to and then let's try and get back what technically was rightfully ours to start with, I guess?
I would suggest that it was a process where they were going, right, we've got to actually wait and see when we can actually do this.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly something that Alfred seems to have been building up with when he talks about the English-speaking peoples, the kin of the English. There's this kind of building up of England as a concept starts then. So, but they've got to wait until they've actually got the power in place and they've got the stability and all the rest to start doing that. So,
yeah,
I don't think there's I don't think there's one trigger.
Mm-hmm. I think it's always kind of on the horizon of that's what they want to do, which I guess would back up the idea, like you said, that Alfred didn't give the land because he wanted to. It was a case of that he had to because he couldn't defeat them outright. So his goal is always to let them exist until he can then come and take it back, or his children can.
Yeah, I think so. Basically.
One question I have for you guys. Since the English king was basically a Saxon king, why are you guys called English and not Saxons?
That's because that was Alfred's cunning plan. The plan's so cunning he could stick a tail on it and call it a weasel. Basically, what he was doing, he was being inclusive. He went, right, I can get these guys in the English side of the country on my side by saying, hey, you're part of our group. We're calling ourselves the same as you. And so, because he's already got his lot on side.
Right.
Bringing the other guys in, bringing the other people in by saying, you know, we're the kin of the English, we're the kin of the Angles, we can do this.
He seems like a thinking king. Rather than this, I guess, because you always think of kings as, especially around this time period, as warlords and or quite ruthless. You have to be, you know, battle hardened. Whereas he seems to be a little bit more cunning and willing to use other tactics to get what he wants.
I think he is more obviously like that. Yeah. I mean, I wonder to what extent other kings were actually more thinking but don't have the reputation for it because they didn't leave the right paperwork behind.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you could say the same thing about a king like Charlemagne and plenty of his successors too. By the way, Louis the Pious is another good example. So, yeah, there are definitely thinking kings out there.
That's a new phrase.
Yeah, thinking king.
Okay, so to swap topics, you know a thing or two about berserkers.
I like to think so, yeah, having written a PhD on it.
So a couple of episodes ago, we had Ruben on who looks at it from more of an archaeological standpoint. So I just wanted to get your perspective on it from your side, I guess.
Okay, how long have we got?
not hours. I mean, we have some time. We have some time.
So one of the things that we were talking about with Ruben was this archaeological perspective is of course that, well, you know, we have some visuals that go along the idea of a figure who, you know, has a headdress that is either a wolf or a bear or something like that, but that doesn't mean that we can necessarily call it a berserkir or ulfhetna. So what's your take on all of that?
Okay, where do I start? Right, I think figures called berserkir and ulfhetna, berserks and wolf skins, existed in the Viking Age. The poem Haraldskvæði in Heimskringla seems to be, although it's a composite poem, it seems to fit together quite nicely. And it mentions them at the Battle of Hofrsfjord about 2-3 miles down the road from where I'm sitting now, which quite frankly geeks me out massively. So it mentions them there in the late 9th century. Mm-hmm. And it's the poetry makes sense, which, given the strictures of Old Norse poetry, Old Norse verse styles, means that it's probably reasonably accurate, and we can probably accept that it dates from this period. It's supposed to have been written down around 900. So in that respect, I think they existed. I don't think they existed in the way that almost everybody imagines them to exist, though. Because when you start reading Old Norse literature and you start reading episodes featuring Berserkir, it's very easy to read them and think, oh, they bit their shields and they howled, and think, wow, that's weird. They must have been nutters. But as soon as you actually start reading it with a perspective of what did the medieval audience actually think? How are these episodes used in the narrative? And more importantly, the tempo of the episodes. You start to see that, in fact, there's probably a lot more going on here. I mean, the example I always use, because it's easy and because lots of people have read Eyjolf's saga, is the duel between Eyjolf and Jotun in Blakey, Jotun the Pale, where at the, basically Eyjolf's going to fight on behalf of the farmer Frithgeir, because Frithgeir's a bit of a wimp and Eyjolf's got to prove himself, and he seems to like fighting. So Jotun at the start of the duel does Berserkskangr, which is usually translated as go berserk, although etymologically it actually means the movement of the berserk, because the word gangr always refers to a physical movement in Old Norse. It doesn't refer to any of the figurative types of go that we have, but it's a noun. Berserkskangr is a noun, and it's composed of two nouns. And I would love to see it translated as the berserker strut, just because. So he does that. And then what you have is Eyjolf makes a bit of verse about him. He basically, it's a Viking Age poetry slam. And he slams Jot with verse. And Jot says, all right then, I'll have you instead. You're going to be a better fight than Frithgeir was ever going to be anyway. So Eyjolf makes some more verse about him because Jot still isn't ready for the fight. And eventually, after about four narrative pauses, the duel begins between the two of them. And that's a heck of a long time for somebody who, according to modern ideas of what Berserkskangr is, had gone berserk, to actually be standing around and still preparing. And then the fight happens, they fight for a bit, and Jot says, oh, I'm a bit tired now, can we have a bit of a rest? So they have a bit of a rest, and Eyjolf makes more poetry, and then they start again, and Eyjolf kills him. And that suggests to me that Berserkskangr would have been perceived as some kind of posturing before the fight.
Okay.
I always compare it to a Maori haka, like the All Blacks do before a rugby match, because I suspect it would have had magico-religious significance, getting Odin on side, if we can link Berserkir to Odin, which I think we reasonably kind of can, but that depends what you mean by Odin. Then possibly, I mean, I say magico-religious because how do we differentiate between the two? What is there a difference? And then on top of that, he performs this because it bolsters his own courage. It gets his adrenaline going a bit. And a haka has cultural and all other different types of significance as well. So I think that's what's going on there. I think that's what the medieval audience would see. And because berserks in the sagas are never associated with any of the serious rage words like over, which is sort of ecstasy, rage, that kind of massive, how do you describe it, inspiration that brings out poetry suddenly from your brain, that kind of thing. I think it's only ever once associated with that word. It's not associated with those others. And where it is associated with other anger words, it's in contexts where in English you would say something like the battle raged or they fought furiously. Doesn't mean they're angry. Doesn't mean they've lost it. It just means it's hard fought.
So I was simply just talking about some sort of ritualized warrior aesthetic that comes with the whole thing, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's basically what it is. And I think that, I mean, given how personal Old Norse religion, the pre-Christian religion in Scandinavia was to people at the time, I think these guys would have been the ones to perform whatever ritual needed to be performed, because they were the ones who were felt to have the closest connection.
It makes a lot of sense.
I want to jump in because I feel like we could do a full episode on this.
We could.
I feel like we should book you back in for our next available slot and do an episode on this, because I feel like we're just going to do a disservice if we try and sum it up in 10-15 minutes at the end of an already quite long episode. Yeah. Rather than delve into, because it seems to me like you have some really, really interesting ideas on it that I've never heard before, and I have a lot of questions I want to ask.
Do they involve mushrooms?
Some of them may do.
Because you could do an entire program on the historiography of berserks and every possible suggestion for what was wrong with them.
That's it. I think we should. I think that should be.
If there's one thing I have to say, if there's one thing I'm tired of, it's that old trope about mushrooms. It's like, fuck you, Thomas Bartholin. Wasn't he the one who,
who proposed? Samuel Erdmann in 1784 came out with mushroom theory.
But we don't we also have Thomas Bartholin from this 1680s, I think. I think that's he writes about it.
Actually, you're right. Erdmann does reference Bartholin.
Yeah.
But what I particularly like is von Strahlenberg, who was a prisoner of the Siberians in 70, who wrote, and his memoirs were published in 1730. And he talks about people making tea from ammonite and muscaria to get pissed at a party. And I only realized that the idea that people actually drank the urine of people who'd eaten the mushrooms actually comes from that memoir, because the poor people couldn't afford the tea, so they stood around with bowls to collect the urine of the rich people to drink it, because they thought it would have some effect. But that's just party time. That's not about battle or shamanism or anything.
It's just people drinking piss. And
sounds like a fun time. No, I think we should definitely save that for a full episode. We will speak after and book in to do it, because I think that will be awesome. You obviously know a lot about this subject. Before we wrap up, we had a brief discussion about how you edited a book and wrote a paragraph on this idea of Viking becoming a brand now in modern society. I think that's quite an interesting thing to speak about. You know, I have a company which deals in this, but it does seem that Viking related businesses are popping up all over the place, not just selling, you know, Norse or Viking inspired products, but in all walks of life, from coffee companies to tool manufacturers to everything.
Oh yeah I mean, you can buy Berserker tea at the Viking Ship Museum in Oslo. I've seen that there.
Has it got mushrooms in it? Or is it urine?
Blueberries, actually. Blueberries.
Wait a minute.
With a hint of piss.
I think you have to supply that yourself.
just to declare, it doesn't have piss in it. I don't want to get sued.
Yeah, Vikings are a very popular brand. They've been used since the 19th century for all kinds of sort of aesthetics, if I can call it that. And the English loved Vikings because they were seafaring types, and the English thought, haha, yes, we're seafaring types and the Vikings are just like us. And the French had their own versions, who had droopy asterisk moustaches. And
it just seems like you stick the word Viking on front of anything.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. But they do. I mean, the idea is that the Vikings are tough, enduring, adventurous, what other words can I use to describe them in positive ways?
Yeah, it kind of screams that you're making a well-made product almost, as like, I know particularly I've seen a tool company, it's like Viking Tools or whatever, and it's like, it does kind of give that idea of that they're going to be strong.
Yeah, strong, endurable survivors. I mean, when we did the World Tree Project, we got so many good things sent in. You know, Viking water sprinklers from, I think it's from Minnesota originally. And basically it's a call back to the homeland from the guy who came and settled over, and all these companies that are about people's heritage as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my favorite one though is the Asgard funeral directors in Berlin.
Wow. Isn't there also a what is it, like varnish or paint or something that's called Jotun?
I don't remember that one, but quite probably.
I'm pretty sure there is, and it might actually be for cars, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. But at least Viking cruisers have actually got the right idea.
That's the one that does work.
Yeah.
So before we do finally wrap up, we've got a couple of questions from the people who've been watching. Paul R. just asked how your World Tree project, how did it end up, or is it still going? Is it a success? Do you want to just tell us a little bit more about it?
Right, the World Tree project, where we were getting people, we were trying to crowdsource resources about the Vikings. The website is still live, can still be visited. It's currently on hiatus. Basically, what we did was we put a call out to people focused on Ireland, the UK, Denmark, and Norway, saying, send us all your Viking-related stuff. So if you see Thor bread in the supermarket, snap a quick shot and send it to us so that we know about it.
Okay.
So basically, what we got was people sending us things that they thought were Viking, which was interesting for us because we didn't curate it at all particularly. We just asked people to say what they associated with Viking-related thing with the Vikings and send that in. And then we targeted pit scholars that we knew and said, have you any teaching resources you'd like to share? And we created a virtual museum with exhibitions and collections related to different themes, different Viking-related themes. And all of it is set up with the idea that you can follow links back to where the original material can be found if it is if it's original. I mean, admittedly, some of those are links back to supermarket websites with products, but...
Sounds awesome.
Oh, it was the best fun I've had in a long time till
this.
I came here, really, yeah. Well, no, actually, till I set up the Danelaw Saga exhibition. Then I came here, yeah.
Flattery gets you everywhere.
Yep.
I imagine this could be quite a long answer, so if we try and keep it short. Sophie asked, she wanted to know where Scotland, Wales and Ireland fit into all of this. I guess that's relating back to the Danelaw. Obviously, you mentioned that some of the Scandinavian kings were kicked out of Ireland.
Right.
If you summarize.
Short version. The Hebrides were settled by Scandinavians. Orkney and Shetland were settled by Scandinavians. The Caithness area north of Scotland was settled by Scandinavians. So, Lemon Vikings everywhere, all around the margins of Scotland. Ireland, you had Norwegians coming in first, then Danes. A lot of the major cities in Ireland were actually effectively trading centres originally, Viking trading centres originally. So you've got a lot of Viking stuff going on in Dublin and Wexford. And recently in Cork, where they've actually found the Vikings under the old Beamish brewery.
Hmm.
So
that's very fitting.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, yeah. So basically, there's a lot of that. A lot of that goes on, and they involve themselves heavily. So in sort of Irish politics as well. So there were Vikings on both sides at the Battle of Clontarf in 1014. Wales has less Viking material, but if I remember correctly, there's material being found on Anglesey. But they don't seem to have settled there so much. And it seems to have been its own country, but with Edward the Elder attacking it. And
the Isle of Man.
Ah, the Isle of Man. Oh, that is total, kind of, oh, I don't want to use the C word, but I don't think Irish is quite the right word. a total mix of Celtic speaking peoples and Old Norse speaking peoples. So you've got the runestones, you've got the ship burial type things going on. It's a real mix. And you're getting Olaf Cuaran, for example, an old Irish Cullenarden by name, that's the word. Old Irish by name with a Norse forename.
Hmm.
So cool. You're getting a good mix of people like that.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty exciting.
It's fantastic as the Isle of Man, yeah. Just because of that mixing, it's fusion culture, and there's lots of runes.
Awesome. Last question before we go. This is quite interesting, actually. Jim asks, do you think that the Danelaw is the origin of the north-south divide historically in England? Because we do, that exists.
Much exists. It's just a question of where the south begins.
That's a huge question. That's hotly
debated. And I'm not going to engage that one today.
Don't, because we'll get in plenty of trouble, I'm sure.
I have different views on who's on the wrong side of the Humber, though. I honestly don't know. I don't particularly think it is. But given that the capital has been in the south for, well, since pretty much forever, I don't know if it's the Danelaw itself, but it's the positioning of the capital that causes the focus to be on the south. Difficult one, and I may be talking rubbish here, but
welcome to my world.
If I can, as a foreigner to England, if I can just like add something here, I actually don't have any mental image of the South except London. Whereas the North of England is just a lot of sheep and stuff like that.
And whippets. Don't forget our whippets.
Whippets, yeah.
So just like, you know, urbanscape, sheep. That's what my mind goes to. But that's because I've been watching that show. What is it called? All Things Great and Small? Is that the one? Yeah.
Yeah. Shouldn't Happen to a Vet or whatever it's called now. Yeah.
Yeah.
All Creatures Great and Small.
All Creatures Great and Small. Yes.
Yes.
Which is like some vet in some northern English area.
Yeah. So
that's what I know. But I have also not been there yet.
No, I'll teach you when you come.
I'm looking forward to that.
We're the good ones up here. That's all you need to know. No, this has been fun. I really enjoy this, and I'm really looking forward to doing one on the Berserker as well.
Yep.
So thank you very much for joining us. Do you have anything you're working on at the minute, anything you want to plug or shout out, let people know?
Viking Leicestershire, published by Five Leaves in Nottingham. Support your local small publisher. It's a primer on Viking Leicestershire, and it's a companion volume to Becca Gregory's Viking Nottinghamshire.
Awesome.
So if you don't really know about the Danelaw, but you want a sort of easy inroad, those two books are great.
Perfect. I will get you some details off you after, and we will stock that on our website.
Yeah.
So people can pick it up from us. Be a nice, easy place for people to get it. Matthias, do you want to let people know where they can find you?
You can find me on Instagram. Just search my name. I'm cutting back on social media presence. You can find me on Instagram.
It's only 50 episodes late.
I mean, you can always Google my name and a bunch of things will come up. So there you go.
Perfect. For the podcast, if obviously you will hear us read sort of questions out at the end of the episode. If you want to get your question and also watch the episodes live, if you support us on Patreon, we record every Tuesday, 7 p.m. UK time and 8 p.m. Central European time. So if you follow us on Patreon, you get access to the live stream and the live chat in there. There's a bunch of people sort of talking throughout the show and a little community going on. You have our website, nordicmythologypodcast.com, where you can get merchandise. The clothing, by the time this goes out, will have arrived with me, and hopefully people will have their items have ordered. The Nordic Mythology Podcast on Instagram, obviously we post our highlight videos on there. You can follow us or subscribe to us on YouTube under the same name, obviously the same name on Facebook. And I think that's everything, maybe. And you can follow me, Daniel_Farrand1 on Instagram. That's me personally, and obviously the business at Horns of Odin as well. And so, yeah, Roderick, thank you very much. This has been fun. I think it'll be very informational and helpful for people who struggle with understanding quite what the Danelaw is. And I'm sure a lot of people will be really looking forward to the Berserker episode as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. No problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. That's the show.